Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
The Sound of Falling Leaves by Lisa Carter. After an aspiring opera singer, Tessa, loses her voice in a fire, she needs both a place to heal and a way to keep music in her life. She retreats to her aunt's apple orchard in rural North Carolina to collect folk ballads. But amid the autumn splendor of this isolated Appalachian community, she uncovers an unnerving connection between a murder case and a long-ago disappearance. Tessa gets a glimpse into an almost forgotten world, encounters a corrupt small-town political dynasty, and finds superstition and prejudice at every turn. She's also drawn to Zeke, the handsome but enigmatic orchard caretaker who shows her that mountain justice is neither impartial nor just. But battling a conspiracy of silence, Tessa isn't sure if she can trust him. Yet somewhere in the mists of the Blue Ridge Mountains, evil lurks, and a killer is determined to keep the past where it belongs, dead and buried.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hemmerker, and I'm so glad you joined me today. My guest is multi-published author Lisa Carter, and I love your little tagline, Lisa, who likes to describe her romantic suspense novels as sweet tea with a slice of murder. So welcome to my show.
Thank you so much for having me today, Sarah.
So, you must be Southern then, sweet tea.
I am.
Yeah, and I love that with a slice of murder because, you know, we want to be genteel as we're talking about murder here. with the sweet tea. Now, I must admit, I grew up in Southern Virginia, and I didn't grow up drinking sweet tea. I know it sounds like a sacrilege to say that. For some reason, my mom, I mean, she made iced tea, sun tea, you know, stick it out under the sun all day, all the time. It never put sugar in it. Just weird.
Wow.
I know, right? So I remember when I went to school, I went to college in Georgia for a couple years, and I remember the first time I ordered tea at a restaurant, it didn't occur to me to specify unsweetened tea, and I got this, you know, sweet tea. And I was like, oh, my God, I couldn't drink it. It was too sweet.
Yeah.
So now I learned my lesson. Always ask, do you have unsweetened? Because they'll just say, we have tea, because everyone knows Southern tea is sweetened. So.
And I make it for my family, and I don't put as much sugar in, for instance, as my mother and my aunt did. I mean, you know, I've seen the time you could stand a spoon in it, and it would stand upright. But
yep.
I don't make it quite that sweet. I think each generation makes it a little less sweet.
Yes, yeah. But that, you know, I still, when we used to be talking about it, I can almost like taste that first nice sun tea of the spring because it's so warm from the, you know, over the cold ice. Anyway, but yeah, that's good. That's good stuff. So let's talk favorite books. Do you have favorite of your books? You've written many books. So do you have favorites? Which child do you love? Which book child do you love the best?
Right. You should not pick favorites among your book children. And I am right now writing my 28th book.
Okay.
I would have to say that probably Under the Turquoise Sky, which won the Carol in 2015 maybe, there was just something about those characters, the setting, their relationship, the hero and the heroine with each other, that just was, I don't know what it was. I've never had another book that came together like that, where it just sort of unfolded for me. Each day I would sit down at the computer, and I'm a pantser. I don't outline what's going to happen in the book, so I kind of know what's going on at the beginning, the characters, the setting, the initial conflict and problem, and I kind of know how I want it to end. But everything in the middle is just one big adventure. And so it's unfolding for me as I'm sitting down to write each day, and it truly was like a movie reel in my head. I would just see the scene, and the characters were talking to each other. They weren't talking to me, because if they were talking to me, that would make me sort of psychotic, but they were talking to each other, and I was just trying to type as fast as I could to capture what was going on in each scene that day, and that was just such a great adventure for me, and I feel like that readers really embraced that book, and for them it was that same sort of adventure, and I've never had another book that just came together so fast that was such a joy and delight, every single aspect of it. And so probably that one would be my favorite of all the suspense books I've written.
So, and I love the title, too. Did you come up with that, or was that your publisher?
I did come up with most of my suspense titles. Now, I write several series for Love Inspired, and usually the way it works over there is that they pick the titles, but it just happened that for all of the suspense books I've written, and I guess total, maybe I'm approaching maybe 10 at this point, the publisher liked the titles, my working titles, and so we went with those.
Yeah, so I'm curious. I haven't seen Under a Turquoise Sky. Is there a turquoise sky on your cover?
There is. And
it's okay, good.
One of these big sandstone arches. It's set in New Mexico on the Navajo Reservation. And so the cover, most of my suspense publishers, I've worked with several over the years, they have done such a great job. I've always been so pleased with the cover designs that the publisher came up with.
Yes, I just had to ask because, you know, Under a Turquoise Sky, it would be very disappointing if it wasn't, if it didn't live up to the hype there. So, whew. So now that was set, you said, in New Mexico. How else do you, and you don't live in New Mexico, right?
I do not. I am from North Carolina.
Okay, so how do you pick your settings? I mean, New Mexico is a fair piece from North Carolina, as they say.
My in-laws lived in Colorado for several decades, and so we made a lot of trips to the Southwest. And my books tend to be set in North Carolina, Virginia, or, for some reason, the Southwest, because that is an area that I'm familiar with since my in-laws lived out there. And so what generally happens is I'm really passionate about traveling, and so I do a lot of traveling, and places just sort of call to me, and I get these ideas and these stories, this spark of inspiration, and I don't know necessarily that I choose the setting so much as the setting and the characters and the story choose me. So I always try to keep my eyes and ears open for the possibilities, I guess.
Yeah, I love that. And I noticed that from your bio, which is included with this podcast, so if you can, listeners, you can read more about her there, that you have a lot of your Love Inspired, which is, or just contemporary romance,
set in
the
Nobody
Blue Ridge.
Dies in those books.
Right, yeah, nobody dies in those books. If you want, you want suspense, she has other ones. But I love that you set them in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I live in Northern Virginia now, not too far from the Shenandoah Valley and the mountains up here. And I just, it is something, you know, they're beautiful. So I can see why you would be attracted to that kind of setting as well. So what do you think is the hardest part of writing romantic suspense?
I think, as a writer, as an author, when you write romantic suspense, there are two story threads that you've got to kind of craft and weave together. There's the romantic tension that you've got going on between your characters, that they've got to overcome certain obstacles that threaten their relationship, or else love will die. That's what's at stake. But then you've also got this thread of suspense where the characters are trying to either find a killer or escape a killer, or someone will die. And because I write from a Christian worldview, there's also the spiritual thread that is running through my novels, where the characters are coming to grips with God's invitation for a relationship, or for something within them vital is going to die. And so for me, I'm weaving together these three story tension threads between the spiritual and the romantic and the suspense. And you know, it's kind of a little dance, I guess, to get it all to come out together in the end.
Right, and then you said, you know, being someone who doesn't write from an extremely detailed outline, and I'm kind of the same way. I start off with the overall idea and my characters, and I know what's going to happen. It's just, it's like you said, how we get there, you know, I couldn't tell you. It happens.
I know. It's very frightening. People
yep.
that are outliners listen to my method, and they think, how do you do it? And honestly, I don't know how I do it. It's surely God. And it leaves me very dependent on him every step of the way, which is probably why he intends it to be that way. And yeah, there's a lot of terror involved in the method that I use.
But I think there's also some surprises too. I think, you know, how God created us and our subconscious and stuff, because I don't know if this happened to you or not, Lisa, but sometimes I'll write something and then later on in the book I'm like, oh, that's why I wrote that.
Yes.
Earlier, because
it's a way of bringing it together.
Yes. Yeah, a way of bringing it together. And then occasionally I'll have to go back and layer, you know, make sure my clues, you know, are in there, so it's not too great a leap of from point A to point B at the end. At the end,
right.
But most
you
of the time,
writing is sort of a three-stage endeavor. There is the pre-writing, which is what I call the power of discovery, when you're discovering the characters and you're discovering the story, the plot line, and that's where you're really doing all your research. And then the second stage is where you're doing the writing, which for me is the hardest part, that blank page and the cursor just blinking at you. And
yes.
Then there is the third stage of writing, which is the editing. And to me, I enjoy the editing, actually. That to me
yeah.
is when it all comes together. That's when the magic happens. It's kind of like you've got this big old hunk of clay, and the editing is where you're really, like when you're chipping away and putting together this sculpture, this where the fine-tune comes into the writing. And so I enjoy the editing. Some people do not. To me, like I said, that middle stage, the writing is where you shed the tears, where it's really, really hard to make what you're hearing in your head, seeing in your mind, having to get that onto the paper.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, and like you said, sometimes writing can be kind of terrifying. Because when you're staring at that
yes.
blank screen, you're like, okay, something needs to happen. So
right.
do you have any, like, favorite ways to kind of get yourself beyond, you know, get yourself motivated when you're at a kind
yeah,
of a roadblock?
I wish I could tell you that I have the answers to that. There's a lot of gnashing of teeth and crying and wailing and that sort of thing that happens. But, yeah, it's just, you know, it's terrifying. If you want to increase your faith, become an author, because, you know, this is where I am. But I think for me, trying to overcome obstacles, I try to do something very mundane that doesn't require a great deal of thought. House cleaning. My house is never so clean as when I'm in that middle stage trying to write the manuscript. I'd take walks. Something about being in nature, I think, can help the imagination overflow in that tank of creativity. I also take a lot of showers. I don't know what it is about the flow of consciousness with the flow of water. My husband, as a joke one time, he printed out our water bill, and you could see on the bar graph that, for instance, maybe October was higher for water usage, and then maybe later on in January there was another spike, and then he wrote across there, yep, this was when she was riding the Stronghold, and this one over here, she was riding Beyond the Cherokee Trail. And so it's kind of funny, but it's true. You can track my water bill and see where I am struggling and when I'm working on a manuscript.
Oh, that's funny, Lisa. Yeah, I can see that. Huh, well, at least he doesn't make you pay the water bill.
That's true.
You're like, thank you. I appreciate that now. Yeah. So when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a female Indiana Jones.
Didn't we all?
Yes. And so I've tried to live my life sort of like that, that life is an adventure. And it's an adventure of faith with God, hand in hand with God. But he has allowed me to do a lot of traveling and have a lot of remarkable experiences. And I feel like all of that has been good fodder for the writing that came later to me. I started writing full-time probably when I was 45. Up until that point, I wrote as a child to entertain myself. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of writing, just stories I would make up in my head. And like the cartoon that used to be on television, Phineas and Ferb, my yard was the place where the neighborhood kids would gather, and they'd come in the summertime, in the afternoons, and they'd say, okay, what are we going to pretend like now? And somehow I had become this, like, director of our summer activities where I would make up some story, and the neighborhood kids would act it out, and that's kind of where I got my start. I come from a long line of storytellers, which there's a big oral tradition in the South, and so mm-hmm. I guess part of that just sort of soaked into my genes, and so I've always been a writer, and I think all of the traveling, all of the adventures that God has allowed me to participate in have just led and put all of that together into the stories that come out of my head. Sometimes my head is a scary place, but
yeah.
I hope that it produces books that are encouraging, uplifting, but also intriguing and will challenge people to think.
No, I love that, that thought of, helping people to think and challenging them and entertaining them with our stories. And when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a writer. So I'm like, hey, people look at me, and I always knew what I wanted to go to college for. I was like, I want to go to college and to be a writer, and that's what I did. I had a pretty successful career working for trade associations on their magazines and stuff before transitioning to work from home when my kids were little. But it's, it is something about spinning those stories, having that imagination that I think whether you become an author or not, but that imagination as a child is so precious, and one that I hope that I had instilled in my kids, at least the opportunity to be bored enough that they could discover that they could make things up.
Right.
kind of my gift to you. When they would complain when they were younger that they were bored, I was like, yes, that's my gift to you. Okay. They're like, Mom, we don't want this gift. I said, yeah. You'll thank me later when you, don't need anything to entertain yourself. So I think it is kind of fascinating the way that our imaginations work, and for those of us who use them to write, I think it's such a blessing. I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't write.
And, even through, I have found through life hardships, and suffering comes to all, that my first editor, who we're just dear friends still, even though I've gone on to other publishing houses, she told me once, she said, what a gift God has given to those of us who write, because it's a way, a catharsis, a way of handling, of working through a lot of times the situations that we might be going on in our personal lives as writers that the public would never know about, but God has given us this as a gift, as a means of coping and working through those situations in our lives. And I think that's true, that we are working through, we are writing about struggles, we're working through our own, and of course it is our prayer, I think most authors would say this, that it is our prayer that God would use those words to touch someone else and then to bring the comfort to someone else that we have received from him.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that that is a great way to end our podcast because we are out of time. So thank you for joining me today, Lisa.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah.
You have been listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense. My guest today was multi-published author Lisa Carter, who writes romantic suspense novels and also romance novels. You can learn more about her in the notes to this podcast, and stay tuned for an excerpt from her latest romantic suspense, The Sound of Falling Leaves.
Now an excerpt from The Sound of Falling Leaves by Lisa Carter. Zeke Sloan would have bet last week's paycheck that without makeup, Tessa Goforth would be pale and washed out like other redheads he'd known. But like so many things when it came to her, he would have been wrong. There was a lot about her that confused him. She was different. Not how he thought she'd be. Working around the apple trees in her great aunt's orchard, he kept a surreptitious eye on her whereabouts, always keeping her within his line of sight, ever alert. The wisest course of action when confronted with an unknown species. She was like an exotic hothouse orchid mysteriously planted in the middle of an Appalachian mountain meadow. She didn't belong here. Not that he did either. He just pulled it off better. Leaning his weight against the top of the ladder, he peered through the leafed-out canopy of trees over to the open door of the apple shed. She wore a pair of torn-at-the-knees jeans, the $100 kind ripped by some fashion designer, and a simple long-sleeved tee. A few days ago, she arrived in a fancy BMW, here to help her aunt do a research project and help him harvest the apples. Her help he didn't need or want. She spent most of her time with her aunt, convalescing at the medical center. But the rest of her time she spent aggravating him. She was jittery, making him uncharacteristically nervous. She wanted to be put to work. She needed to be busy. There were shadows under her eyes. Her natural slenderness had become a painful thinness. Coming and going like he did, he'd seen the farmhouse lights blazing at all hours of the night. She was too quiet, except for arguing with him, questioning everything he did, looking over his shoulder, like one of those obnoxious needling burrs in the meadow that stick to your clothes. For his own sanity, he set her to grading the picked apples this afternoon, out of his way. So, hair swept out of her face and fastened in a high ponytail behind her head, she sorted the stamens. As for that hair of hers, he almost fell out of the tree thinking about her hair. Red didn't begin to describe it. A fiery golden copper, not unlike the heirloom apple he held in his hand. Her knee-buckling tresses. The mouth gone dry, strands of silk. The stomach clench. Zeke scowled. He didn't like redheads. His heart thumped from the crisp mountain air of early autumn. Certainly not because of her. Tucking the Rome Beauty into the Cavus pick sack slung across his body, he climbed down the ladder. Zeke had taken his eyes off her just long enough to get his feet on solid ground when suddenly she emerged from behind the gnarled trunk. Hand to her creamy white throat, she jolted and stepped back a pace. I didn't see you there. Zeke grunted, whereas he saw her everywhere, unfortunately. She curled her lip. Always so eloquent, Ezekiel. He'd always hated his name. Somehow she sensed that and used it against him at every turn. Says the ginger. Annoyance flashed from those green foxfire eyes of hers, from which he took not a small amount of satisfaction. The dislike was mutual. He didn't know what it was about her that riled him up so much. Probably a gut reflex to the hair. Her hair. He rubbed his tingling fingers down the side of his jeans. Tapping her running shoe on the grass, she folded her arms. Not hard to imagine her opinion of him. A crude, not-so-bright mountain hick. Worthless. Shiftless. A good old boy. Exactly how he wanted her to think of him. Safer for them both. She closed her eyes for a second before glaring at him. I'm headed to town to visit Aunt Dicey. He glanced at the horizon above the ridgeline.
The light goes quick once the sun gets behind the trees. Outside town, there aren't street lights. You're not used to driving the mountain roads.
Tossing her head, her ponytail swung. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your concern. She was good at sarcasm, a defense mechanism Dicey had warned. Whatever. He didn't enjoy being on the sharp end of her tongue. You're not my father, Ezekiel. He clenched his teeth.
No, I'm not.
I'm a grown woman. He was well aware of that. Too aware. She had this husky, spoken voice. Tessa wrinkled her nose. Orchard manager, that's your job title, right? Such a Flatlander snob. Does not mean you get to manage me. He grimaced.
Somebody needs to.
The look she gave him scorched the earth between them. When I want your advice, I'll ask for it. Ponytail swinging, she stalked down the orchard row toward the white-framed two-story farmhouse.
Good riddance.
He shucked under the strap of the pick sack. Time for him to call it a day as well. She wasn't his problem, thank God. With her gone, he could focus on what was of real interest to him in this backwater end of nowhere in Roebuck County, North Carolina. Fitting in with the local boys. Ingratiating himself with the Cozart political machine that ran this county in the heart of Appalachia. And making himself indispensable to a gang of murderers.
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.